Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. A Hamas official says that after a weeks-long hiatus, international mediators have resumed negotiating with the militant group and Israel over a ceasefire in Gaza, and that he was hopeful a deal to end the 14-month war was within reach. An official in Hamas's political wing, Bassem Naim, said Thursday in an interview with the Associated Press that there have been efforts to end the fighting, release hostages from Gaza, and free Palestinian prisoners in Israel.
What I got from our brothers and colleagues in the movement, that yes, there are reactivation of the negotiation talks.
But Naim said that no quote-unquote solid, well-formed new ceasefire proposal has yet been presented to Hamas. Ceasefire negotiations were halted last month when Qatar suspended its talks with mediators from Egypt and the United States over frustration with a lack of progress between Israel and Hamas. A ceasefire was declared last week between Israel and Hamas ally Hezbollah in Lebanon. Video released on Telegram shows Syrian insurgents sweeping into the central city of Hama after days of intense clashes with government forces. The Syrian army said Thursday it has withdrawn from Hama after insurgents broke through its defenses. It is yet another setback for President Bashar al-Assad, only days after losing control of the city of Aleppo. The Syrian army said it redeployed from Hama and took positions outside the city to protect civilians. The stunning week-long offensive appears likely to continue, with the insurgents setting their sights on the central city of Homs. This is VOA News. U.S. senators on Capitol Hill will soon be weighing in on President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The traditional process in the nation's capital. President-elect Donald Trump's nominees for key cabinet positions meeting with the U.S. senators who will decide if they should be confirmed. Trump's pick to lead the U.S. State Department, Republican Senator Marco Rubio, is expected to be confirmed.
The president sets foreign policy. Our job at state will be to execute.
But Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, has never held a leadership position in the military. He was a host on the conservative Fox News network.
We're putting the warfighters first. That's what Donald Trump asked me to do. Your job is to bring a warfighting ethos back to the Pentagon.
Hegseth is one of several nominees with a history of controversial policy remarks that some Republican senators could have a hard time confirming. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. Secret Service's acting director is vowing big changes in the agency's culture and operations after the assassination attempt against Trump in the state of Pennsylvania. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Ronald Rowe says it was an abject failure and he's taking action.
We are reorganizing and reimagining this organization.
But as he appeared before a bipartisan House task force, panel members pushed Rowe on how so many things went wrong, like a drone operator unable to get his drone to work and a counter sniper positioned behind a tree.
Yet nobody said anything.
Democrat Jason Crow and a fellow veteran Republican Mark Green.
Apathy and complacency, period.
Rowe says when he was a protective agent, everyone felt empowered to speak up when something wasn't right.
I don't know where we lost that.
The panel's public report on the shooting will be out next week. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Law enforcement officials say there was writing on the bullets used to kill an American healthcare executive. AP correspondent Jake Offenhartz reports from New York.
The masked gunman who fatally shot the chief executive of United Healthcare on a Manhattan sidewalk Wednesday used ammunition emblazoned with the words deny, defend, and depose. That's according to law enforcement officials, who also told the AP that the shooter used a silencer on his gun. A motive in the killing has not yet been identified, but the words may refer to a strategy used by insurance companies to deny coverage to patients.
AP correspondent Jake Offenhartz. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
chaos in Georgia.
85% of the people have expressed desire to join the UN, have EU aspirations.
Amnesty International says Israel is committing genocide.
These crimes were and continue to be deliberate actions.
And a look at Trump's cabinet picks.
We will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their positions so they can begin to implement this agenda.
Today is Friday, December 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. This, according to an analysis published Thursday by the human rights group Amnesty International. The report says that Israel has carried out acts prohibited under the Genocide Convention with the specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza. These acts include killings, causing serious bodily or mental harm, and deliberately inflicting on Palestinians in Gaza conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction. Israel has repeatedly denied accusations of genocide, insisting it is defending itself from terrorists who want to destroy it. Henry Ridgewell has more.
Over 44,000 Palestinians have been killed in 14 months of fighting in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. The figure includes militants, but Hamas says the majority of the dead are civilians, including more than 13,000 children. Israeli attacks have leveled entire neighborhoods. The United Nations says 1.9 million people in Gaza, 90% of the population, have been forced to flee their homes. Aid agencies warn Palestinians in northern Gaza are on the brink of starvation. In a report published Thursday, Amnesty International said Israel's actions amount to genocide. Agnes Callamard is the organization's Secretary General.
These crimes were and continue to be deliberate actions, deliberately calculated to bring about the destruction of Palestinians in Gaza. They have also been perpetrated with total impunity. The conclusion that Israel is committing genocide is unequivocal, evidence-based.
Amnesty also cited the language used by some Israeli officials, such as the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who called for Gaza to be crushed. Again, Agnes Callamard.
We found statements calling for genocidal act and other crimes under international law. We verified videos of soldiers replicating those narratives, calling for the erasure of Gaza, or to make it uninhabitable.
Israel strongly denies committing genocide and said the Amnesty report is entirely false and based on lies. The Israeli military says Hamas fighters hide in schools and hospitals, using civilians as human shields. The claims are difficult to verify, as Israel does not allow foreign journalists into Gaza. Israel also accuses Hamas of carrying out a genocidal massacre in its cross-border attack on October 7th last year, which killed more than 1,200 people. More than 240 people were taken hostage. The Israeli government maintains it is acting in self-defense within international law. Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon, spoke to reporters Wednesday ahead of an emergency UN session on Gaza.
We will never waver in our determination to defend our people, protect our future, and bring all of our hostages back home.
Will Amnesty's report have any impact on the war in Gaza? Middle East analyst Andreas Krieg of King's College London.
There are two centers of gravity for this war in Israel, for the Israelis. One is the U.S. government and the support of the U.S. government. The other one is domestic public opinion and the pressure on the government to do one or the other in Gaza. I think this report will have no impact on either of these centers of gravity.
Amnesty cautioned that Israel's allies, including the United States, could be complicit in the alleged genocide and urged them to stop supplying weapons. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
The situation in Georgia is tense. This follows the decision by the ruling party called Georgian Dream to withdraw the country's application to join the EU, sparking massive and often violent protests. For the latest, I'm joined by Anna Kalandadze. She's the chief of VOA's Georgian service.
Well, yesterday, on December 4th, it was sort of the first time when the ruling party, that's the same as Georgian Dream, escalated the repressive tactics by sending police to raid the homes and offices of opposition figures, media, activists, which was very troubling to observe. As we know that already yesterday, several European countries and today just Ukraine imposed individual sanctions on Bidzina Ivanishvili, who is the unofficial de facto ruler of Georgia and the honorary chairman of the Georgian Dream Party.
Now, large protests are one thing, but is the majority of the population supportive of the protesters, rather, is the majority of the population against Georgian Dream's decision to pull back from the EU?
Well, your question goes back to the election, pivotal election that sparked the whole controversy in the society, parliament elections on the 26th of October, that was really a choice between going to Russia or going westward for Georgian people. Majority of people participated in these elections, but very unexpectedly, the Georgian Dream Party claimed the victory of 54%. That's why people are not still believing that's the real result. And the local watchdogs, as well as all watchdogs outside of the country, say the electoral process was rigged and demand the rerun of the vote. Exactly the electoral rigging and the repressive tactics used to rig the election, as well as the recent statements by Georgia's leadership to abort the EU succession process, sparked the protests these days and led to the violent crackdowns by the government.
Now, in a few minutes, following this interview on the show, we're going to hear from our correspondent in Kyiv, and she's making the parallel between Georgia now and Ukraine in 2013-2014, when the pro-Russia and pro-EU forces in Ukraine were starting to split just before Putin invaded. Are Georgians seeing it the same way?
A lot of parallels, similar parallels have been made between Georgia now and Ukraine back in 2013. A lot of similarities have been exposed in the actions by governments of Georgia these days and the Ukrainian leadership. Back in 2013, we can comfortably say that the Georgian people in whole being westward oriented, 85% of the people have expressed desire to join the EU and have EU aspirations. According to the recent polls, similar was, I think, the case with the Ukrainian people being very pro-Western back 10 years ago. So at this point, we have to see international powers dictate or guide Georgians to accomplish.
Anna Kalandadze is the chief of VOA's Georgian service. Anna, thanks for taking the time to chat with me on what is no doubt a very busy and stressful day for you.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here.
Georgia is a former Soviet republic, torn between deepening its ties with Moscow or looking westward to the EU. It's a situation not unlike the one Ukraine faced in 2013 before Putin's invasion. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, sees the parallels and is eager to not only help pull Georgia out of Russia's orbit, but gather worldwide support to do so. Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky announced on Thursday that he signed a decree authorizing Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council's decision to impose sanctions on leadership and members of the Georgian Dream Party in Georgia. Zelensky accused the Georgian Dream of surrendering Georgia to Russia. While nothing has actually been surrendered, Georgian Dream does seek closer ties with Moscow than with the EU. This tension has caused mass protests in the country. Zelensky encouraged European and U.S. allies to join in sanctions. He mentioned that if the world won't respond in time or fails to respond with principle, then decades are lost and countries are robbed of their freedom. He encouraged allies not to lose anyone in this region, Georgia, Moldova, or Ukraine, and to stand united against Russia. Zelensky said Ukraine has imposed sanctions against Bidzina Ivanishvili, the leader of Georgian Dream, and his allies, 19 people in total, that Zelensky says are abandoning the interests of Georgia and its people. The current situation in Georgia recalls in Ukraine the events in 2013 and 2014, when Ukrainian people went to Maidan Square to protest against then-President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to stop EU integration and turn to deeper cooperation with Russia. Ukrainian society feels emphatic and supportive of Georgians as they understand what the Georgian nation is going through right now. Ukrainians believe that free and European-oriented Georgia is what would make Russia weaker in the region. Also, on Thursday, President Zelensky made a speech urging the allies to put more pressure on Russia to free Ukrainians from Russian captivity. This comes after information about the death of the mayor of the occupied city of Dniprorudne in the Zaporizhia region, Yevhen Matveyev, was confirmed. Russian troops captured him in March 2022. During the last exchange, his body was returned to Ukraine. Reportedly, he died as a result of torture. Zelensky called on partners to create an international military tribunal to bring Russian war criminals to justice. He noted that the world should react more harshly to Russia's abduction of Ukrainian children and the murder of military and civilian prisoners of war. Zelensky reported that at least six Ukrainian mayors and community leaders remain in Russian captivity. They are among thousands of Ukrainians who have been captured by Russia since 2014. 3,767 Ukrainians have already been returned from captivity. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Now to Georgia's southwestern neighbor. Turkish-backed Syrian rebels' recent victories are threatening to stoke tensions between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. They're the main outside players in Syria's 13-year-long civil war. But some analysts predict diplomacy could prevail, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
As Syrian rebels made rapid gains against Damascus forces, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi held talks Monday with his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan. Turkey, a backer of the Syrian rebels, has been calling for dialogue with Damascus, and Fidan has said those talks would now need to include the Syrian opposition. But the latest upsurge in fighting in Syria underscores differences between Ankara and Tehran. Bilgehan Alagöz is a professor of international relations at Istanbul's Marmara University.
Iran administration is putting most of its efforts to have some more leverage over Assad's regime, and they are very cautious and resistant against a possible Turkey-Assad dialogue. Iran is maybe not an enemy of Turkey, but it isn't behaving in a friendly way towards Turkey.
Moscow, like Tehran, has much to lose in Syria. Russia is a vital military backer of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who has granted Russia's navy use of a key Syrian base. Sal Gazimov is a professor of history and a specialist on Russia at the University of Bonn.
Moscow and Iran. For them, it's of crucial importance that the personality of Assad remains in power. Russia would definitely use its military forces, its aerospace forces that can cause huge number of casualties among the civilians, Syrian civilians, which means a new wave migrants.
More than a million Syrian refugees are camped just across the Turkish border in the rebel-controlled Idlib province in Syria. Turkey already hosts more than 4 million refugees, and analysts say any Russian assault that triggers a new exodus would trigger a response from Ankara. Murat Aslan is with the SETA Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research, a Turkish pro-government think tank.
There's a line that Turkey will not remain as it is. I mean, if there is a development directly threatening interests or security of Turkey, Turkey will intervene.
Despite backing rival sides in the Syrian civil war, Turkey and Russia have succeeded in managing those differences, and their leaders have maintained a close relationship. The two discussed Syria in a phone call Tuesday. Analysts say both consider their relationship too important to lose over Syria. Russia specialist Zal Gazimov.
Not to that extent that Moscow would jeopardize its cooperation with Turkey, which is of paramount importance for Russian policy towards the world. Moscow and Ankara would demonstrate political pragmatism and try to solve the differences in views through negotiations with each other.
Under the so-called Astana process, Russia, Turkey and Iran have collaborated on Syria in the past. Analysts say the Astana process could be revived if all sides are interested in pursuing a diplomatic solution to the drawn-out conflict in Syria. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
An anti-terrorism court in Pakistan indicted, jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan and several close associates on Thursday for allegedly inciting supporters to attack military installations during an anti-government protest in 2023. The 72-year-old former prime minister and his co-defendants asserted their innocence of Thursday's charges stemming from the violent protests that occurred on May 9th of 2023.
Paraguay has accused a Chinese diplomat of interfering in its domestic affairs and has given him 24 hours to leave the country, escalating tensions over the country's long friendship with Taiwan. Paraguay's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in a brief statement on Thursday that it had revoked the visa of Zhu Wei, a senior Chinese envoy to Latin America, who was in Paraguay for an annual UNESCO meeting. Zhu skipped the UNESCO session on Wednesday and instead turned up at Congress in the capital of Asuncion, where he called on Paraguay to ditch Taiwan, the self-governing island that China claims as its territory.
An earthquake briefly triggered a tsunami warning for the U.S. West Coast on Thursday. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, the quake struck west of Ferndale, California, a small city in the coastal Humboldt County area near the Oregon border. It was felt as far south as San Francisco. There were no immediate reports of major damage or injury.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Shifting gears now, it's time for our daily dive into American politics. Senators on Capitol Hill will soon be weighing in on President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet picks. With many of the nominees facing questions about their beliefs and qualifications, the confirmation process could look different this time around. VOA's congressional correspondent Kathleen Gibson has more.
The traditional process in the nation's capital. President-elect Donald Trump's nominees for key cabinet positions meeting with the U.S. senators who will decide if they should be confirmed. Chuck Grassley is a Republican senator.
Your 8 years and previous experience to being Attorney General of Florida for 8 years prepares you, I'm sure, well for this job.
Trump's pick to lead the U.S. State Department, Republican Senator Marco Rubio, is expected to be confirmed.
The president sets foreign policy. Our job at state will be to execute.
But Pete Hegseth, Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, has never held a leadership position in the military. He was a host on the conservative Fox News network.
We're putting the war fighters first. That's what Donald Trump asked me to do. Your job is to bring a war-fighting ethos back to the Pentagon.
Hegseth is one of several nominees with a history of controversial policy remarks that some Republican senators could have a hard time confirming. Shannon O'Brien is an associate professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin.
Incoming President Trump needs to not just assume they're going to fall in line, because you might have some that, on the Republican side, if they are not given their due diligence or their due deference, they can make his life really tough.
The incoming Senate Majority Leader, Republican John Thune, pledged to swiftly hold votes on Trump's nominees.
We will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their positions so they can begin to implement his agenda.
But Trump has proposed installing appointees while the Senate is in recess, a sometimes controversial maneuver to bypass lawmakers' constitutional role of approving nominees.
What if the president tried to intentionally adjourn Congress using that power in order to make recess appointments? That's never happened. But when he says that he wants to make them, the only way he could possibly force that would be to force the adjournment of Congress. But that's going to wind up in the courts.
Republican senators are already pushing back. John Cornyn is a Republican senator.
Well, that's another whole issue. Obviously, I don't think we should be circumventing the Senate's responsibilities.
U.S. presidents of both parties have made recess appointments, but the Supreme Court limited that ability during the term of President Barack Obama. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, in France, President Emmanuel Macron has vowed to stay in office until the end of his term in 2027, and he announced that he'll name a new prime minister within days. This just one day after his government fell in a no-confidence vote, a first in more than 60 years. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Voici le résultat du scrutin.
It didn't take long for Michel Barnier's three-month-old government to become the shortest in the history of France's Fifth Republic. On Wednesday, National Assembly lawmakers from the far left and far right passed a no-confidence measure. It's left France without a functioning government for the second time this year. The move came after Barnier used a constitutional tool to force through an unpopular budget proposal that he said was key to addressing France's sizable economic troubles. Far-right leader Marine Le Pen told French TV that Barnier's proposed spending cuts and tax increases were profoundly unjust for ordinary people, expressing optimism a better budget could be passed under a new government.
Et pour sortir de l'impasse dans lequel elle a placé.
Mathilde Panot from the far-left France Unbound party said it was time for Macron himself to leave office. Macron says he's not going anywhere. But after losing legislative and European elections earlier this year, he's a weakened president. France is struggling with a high debt and budget deficit and stagnant growth. Public sector workers went on strike Thursday over salaries and working conditions, disrupting schools, city halls, hospitals, and transportation. A rail worker strike is expected next week. France's turmoil comes at a challenging time for Europe. Another European Union heavyweight, Germany, is also struggling economically and politically. The bloc faces internal divisions, an emboldened Russia, a struggling Ukraine, and an incoming Trump administration in the U.S., which Europeans fear will be less inclined to support Kyiv, free trade, and the transatlantic alliance. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.